And now Kurdistan is divided in two. There are two parliaments because it has regional autonomy. And it was granted that actually in the 70s, before Saddam came to power, it had a sort of regional autonomy. And the war against the Kurds was full of all sorts of contradictions. They would be granted regional autonomy, and there would be massacres against their villages and assassinations of their leaders. And while all this violence was being perpetrated, Saddam wouldn't like make lectures demonizing the Kurds. He would instead go to Kurdistan and dress up like a Kurd and say, "Oh, we're all Iraqis, and you know, we respect Kurdistan." But in fact, he was, you know, trying to crush the Kurds. So the political culture of Iraq is full of these kinds of contradictions. So you get to Kurdistan, and you see that in fact these two parties, during the no-fly, the enforcement of the sanctions and the no-fly zones in the 1990s under Clinton, they had a relative security in Kurdistan because Saddam's troops had a hard time venturing in there because they couldn't bring air cover. They did go in, but they didn't do it with as much force as they had previously. The Kurdish parties, after a couple years, fell into fighting among themselves and fought a very vicious civil war against each other in the late 1990s. So the average Kurd is either one of these party loyalists who hates the other party, or more likely, just the you know, regular farmer or cab driver who thinks that both of these parties are totally corrupt and don't really stand for anything politically. Likewise, within the Sunni resistance, it's intensely fragmented, and there are all sorts of political currents within the Sunni resistance. There's one element of the resistance that's basically just criminals at war. There's another element of the resistance that are profoundly fundamentalists fighting a religious jihad. There's another element that are the old officer corps of Saddam's regime who use as their discourse the language of jihad and those motifs, but are really fundamentally Iraqi nationalists and don't care that much whether women are veiled or not. Really what they are motivated by in many cases is a type of intense racism against the Shia and the Kurds and a feeling that they, as a class and a group, deserve to rule Iraq as they always have. And if they can do that through some sort of secular Arab nationalism, fine. If it requires that they do it through some sort of Al-Qaeda-style jihadist ideology, fine. Whatever the ideological vehicle is secondary to the fact that they, as an interest group, need to be in charge of the country. So that's a very, very simplified sketch of the political terrain. Layer over that the fact that Saddam started preparing for the U.S. invasion and occupation even before it happened, or at least his officer corps did. They began essentially organizing the embryonic cells of what would become the resistance. There were 450,000 people in Iran, in Iraq's army and security forces. L. Paul Bremer, the Bush administration representative in Iraq who was running the occupation, had the brilliant idea of firing all of these people, which was insane because even a small fraction of 450,000 well-trained, disciplined soldiers deciding not to just surrender, but to continue their fight underground, that translates into a rather formidable guerrilla force. So one of the ways that Saddam prepared for the invasion was by, as I mentioned earlier, emptying Abu Ghraib, emptying all the prisons. So a couple of months before the invasion, there was this incredible crime wave in Iraq. And in some ways, I mean, to my mind, that's when the resistance begins, when Saddam starts laying the groundwork for the total disintegration of law and order in Iraq. And the basic theory of the Sunni resistance seems to me to be essentially their proposition is to the foreign forces, primarily the U.S. that are there, they say, you know, we will burn this country to the ground and destroy everything in it before we will let you have it. And they're very serious about that. And so that's a pretty formidable position to be fighting from. So that crime wave helped, and this unleashed criminal class, it's now become clear, was essential in how the Sunni resistance kicked off its organization. In the summer of 2003, these old officers would use these criminals to experiment with attacks on the U.S. and watch how this was done, pay these guys to do this, and then as they developed their tactics, the former soldiers and officers would get more and more involved in the fight. So it's been useful for their resistance, but one of the side effects has been that Iraq is in the midst of an unbelievable crime wave. We hear about kidnapping of journalists and foreign aid workers, though not so much anymore because most of them are locked down or gone. But what there still is and what there was throughout the first 2.5 years of the occupation was massive kidnapping of middle-class Iraqis, their children and their family members. There was a huge trade in kidnapping for ransom, bank robberies, home invasions, vehicle theft. When I was there in the summer of 2003, I routinely met, basically every Iraqi I met knew somebody personally who had been killed in, not the war, but in some sort of crime incident. And with no police force, that only exacerbated it. And inevitably now this crime wave takes the form of something that appears to be the war, but you can never quite be sure. So I was interviewing a group of Kurdish truckers, all of whom had stopped driving into Arab areas because they knew they would be killed. And each one of them told the story of having been pulled over by guys dressed in police uniforms who took their trucks, kidnapped them, maybe killed their friends, somehow they escape or get released. And invariably, these men were either the police acting as criminals, criminals dressed up in stolen police uniforms acting like the police, or the police in league with the resistance trying to sabotage the economy, or criminals working for the resistance dressed as police sabotaging the economy. Who knows what it was, but it translated into this horrendous crime wave that was then also mixed in not just with this resistance against occupying forces, but a sectarian warfare where Arab roadblocks would ask if there were any Kurds. This one guy told a story of these armed Sunni men in police uniforms who were the resistance, who might also have been U.S.-trained cops, because a lot of the forces that the U.S. trains, people enter them, they get guns, they get training, and they, all along, they were with the resistance. I interviewed a guy, and in my book, I write about it, the guy who was in the Iraqi military academy and in the army, who was then in the resistance around Balad, and then when I interviewed him, he claimed he wasn't in the resistance anymore, and he was joining the new Iraqi army. I doubt he was going to completely let go of his old Ba'athist sympathies once he was fully integrated into the Iraqi army. So anyway, yeah, this is the situation in Iraq now. And that poses a question of, for the U.S. military, how exactly would you define victory in that situation? Who exactly is the enemy? Would the government of Iraq be the enemy that we're supporting, that we're funding? Or would just certain factions of it be the enemy? And how would you determine which factions and who and at what level? How high up the food chain within the Badr Brigade would you need to go before you cross from enemies loyal to Iran to friends loyal to the U.S.? The complexity of that situation, I think, is essentially impossible for an organization like the U.S. military to win, because it's not built for that. The U.S. military is built to fight large conventional wars against other conventional armies. It wasn't prepared and trained for guerrilla warfare, urban guerrilla warfare. And what I'm trying to say now is that the situation in Iraq isn't even as simple as fighting an urban guerrilla war. And then dealing with Afghanistan briefly, so you get a sense of what's going on there. And I should say, actually, yesterday, the translator that I work with when I go to Afghanistan, his name is Ajmal, was kidnapped down in the south where the Taliban are very much in charge. He was with an Italian journalist who writes for La Repubblica and with another Afghan, and they were kidnapped. His name is Ajmal. You can read about this in the International Herald Tribune, BBC, and elsewhere. So the situation in Afghanistan is also deteriorating. And it's deteriorating, I think, fundamentally because that project was always held hostage, pardon the metaphor, to Iraq. The Bush administration, after 9/11, used Afghanistan as essentially a casus belli to get to Iraq. And you can see this written in the lackluster way in which the administration embraced the project in Afghanistan. The first thing is they used the war there as an advertisement for Rumsfeld's theory of fast, light, high-tech war, where there wouldn't be many casualties. You just have special forces, air traffic controllers embedded with local forces, bomb people from the sky, the Taliban get scared and run away, and then you call in the Europeans and their NGOs, and they can rebuild Iraq and everybody, and the inter-American, and not rebuild Iraq, rebuild Afghanistan, and the inter-American and every Afghan will start to blossom, and you can quickly move on to Iraq. And that's what they did. And they used very few troops. The first 2 years of the occupation, there were only 8,000 or 9,000 U.S. troops at any one time in the country. And with the tooth-to-tail ratio, as they say, in the U.S. Army, the number of support and logistics people necessary to field one soldier, that translates into about a battalion of soldiers at any one time who were actually out in the field hunting for Osama bin Laden. So the first 2 years of the occupation were really basically like an elaborate manhunt for al-Qaeda on the border with Pakistan, and not a project of nation-building and trying to secure this very underdeveloped, lawless country that never really had a centralized functioning modern state, that went through 25 years of war, that has drug trafficking as its main economic industry. The most damning fact of all about the Bush administration's approach to Afghanistan was the fact that in 2002, the Republicans in their budget proposed zero aid for Afghanistan. Because in their minds, Afghanistan was a war that had already been won in 2001, and now it's on to Iraq. It wasn't a country that needed to be rebuilt. That was a very humiliating oversight, and it was quickly rectified, and they committed $300 million that year. Overall, there's been $5 billion spent in Afghanistan, basically $1 billion for each year of the occupation. But unfortunately, that money, which is not very much, given the fact that there's such intense needs. There were essentially no paved roads in Afghanistan when the U.S. came in. There had been, but they had all fallen into such disrepair over the generation, the decades of war, that there were no paved roads. There are 28 million people in Afghanistan, as many as in Iraq. Tremendous need for everything from power and water to education to basic financial capital for starting businesses. And the problem with what was essentially an inadequate amount of money, they could have used a lot more than $5 billion, was that it was handled in a very slipshod fashion. And one of the main problems was that the Bush administration, in trying to show that Afghanistan was a success, set this timeline for the political development of the country, creating a constitution, elections, presidential elections. They rushed all of this. And what happened in the process was that you got the creation of a government that is totally dysfunctional. Now, I don't say this from some sort of anti-government position, which is a very popular kind of ideology in the United States. Always blame government as inefficient and bad. That's not where I'm coming from. I think actually that governments serve a very important purpose. But the fact matters that the Afghan government is this incredibly bloated, incredibly corrupt, totally ramshackle, nonsensical, essentially like organized crime institution. There are 32 ministries. Germany, with 80 million people, has 8 ministries. So there's less than a million people per ministry. Some of these ministries have overlapping functions. It's not clear who's responsible for what. There's, you know, a ministry for water and energy, and there's a ministry for mines and power, and they're always competing over who gets what. 95% of the budget comes from foreign aid. Most of that is basically stolen by these ministries, and you hand it out in the form of jobs to your loyal, your relatives or your tribesmen or your party loyalists. And the government is incapable of actually doing anything. The other 5 or 6% of their budget comes from taxing traffic that comes in from Iran or Uzbekistan or Pakistan. So as a result, what you have are police officers in Afghanistan are paid between $80 and $100 a month. People will actually bribe government officials and pay them to get those jobs, not because they are so desperate for the $180 a month, but because they want the right to shake down trucks on the road and shake down opium farmers. So they will pay to have a job as a cop. That's how corrupt Afghanistan is. My friend Ajmal, who was just kidnapped 2 days ago, very successful guy. He was jailed under the Taliban, had no reason to welcome the Taliban back. He was jailed for having long hair. He cut his hair like Leonardo DiCaprio in Titanic because the underground video cassette scene in Afghanistan during the 90s involved lots of watching the Titanic. So the Taliban caught him when he was like 16 having this long hair, and they said, "Oh, you have Titanic hair." And so they shaved his head and beat him up and threw him in jail for a while. Not a guy who would like the Taliban. as a brilliant young guy with great business sense, great language abilities, he became a very important fixer and interpreter for journalists, opened several guest houses, made a lot of money, bought a big apartment. And real estate prices in Kabul actually are similar to New York real estate prices because there's so much money from the UN, so much money from drugs being laundered, and so little real estate because so much of the city has been destroyed. So he actually paid like, you know, a fair sum of money, $95,000 for that kind of old Soviet-style apartment of a couple bedrooms. When I saw him this fall, he was saying what I thought were kind of crazy, borderline pro-Taliban things because he was so angry because he was being shaken down by judges. And what happened was his brother, in running one of these guest houses, there had been a theft or a fight or something like that. And so the police came along, arrested his brother. They had to bribe their way out, and they bribed off these judges. And then his brother saved up enough money, got married, moved to Europe to escape the impending demise of Afghanistan. And a year later, the judges decided that they wanted more money from Ajmal. So they pulled him in and they started demanding that he come have tea with them and negotiate how much they were going to charge for resolving this case. And not only shake him down for money, but humiliating him and making great display of their power over him. And this was infuriating this guy. And so he said, he's like, I'm so sick of this corruption. I don't care if I have to grow my beard long again. Let the Taliban come in again. I'll pay for them because at least, despite all their faults, they weren't corrupt. So that's a measure of how problematic the Afghan government is. And the Afghan government is fundamentally a creation, a byproduct of this rushed political process. And it was rushed so that the U.S. could get to Iraq. So the situation there, you know, what that translates into then is that the Pashtun elements of the population, they're 40% of the population in Afghanistan. And the Taliban, which we always think of as a religious movement, is a religious movement, but all of the parties in Afghanistan are religious. They're all Sunni fundamentalist or Shia fundamentalist parties. But the Taliban are also, and all of these parties are also ethnically based. And the Taliban is the party of the Pashtun, the majority group in Afghanistan. And the Pashtun have always run Afghanistan. Karzai is Pashtun. So a lot of the Pashtun population, in the face of the corruption and abuse of their government, are starting to welcome back the Taliban. Because the fact of the matter is, the Taliban do stuff like they come into towns where these people have purchased their job as the cop and they get to throw their weight around and they give the local cop or judge one warning, and if they don't leave, they kill them. And then they tell the farmers to say, yeah, you can grow opium poppy and we won't tax you more than a set amount. And once you have paid this taxation, this is a god, that's it. You're not going to be shaken down again. And it's a horrible situation, but for many people, they think it's better than having to deal with the uncertainties of the shenanigans that are the Karzai regime. So anyway, that's sort of like a report from the field of sorts. And so it leaves us with a situation where this is clearly a crisis. Why? How do we get here? And how do we get out? Several fundamental reasons why the U.S. went to Iraq. The first one is the geostrategic importance of the oil of the Middle East. So this is essentially the indirect and political control and uses of that oil, rather than trying to get that oil so you can sell it, so U.S. firms can sell it, or to put it in your gas tank, but rather to situate the U.S. military as the security force that guarded that oil. Now, why would the U.S. want to do that? Because the Middle East's oil is the source of fuel and will increasingly be the source of fuel for the two other main poles of the world economy, Europe and Asia, Asia being centered increasingly around China and India rather than Japan. And what situating U.S. military forces in the role of being the petroleum gendarme, the security force for the world's energy supply, what that would do is give the U.S. indirect but very important leverage over its allies, but also its economic rivals. So, I mean, the EU is clearly, you know, the European states that make up the EU are clearly allies with the U.S., but there are also important economic rivalries. And in those rivalries, it is very useful for the U.S. to have some sort of background dependency established so that the Europeans don't try and resist the desires of U.S. corporations or the U.S. government too much. An example of this would be around chemical standards. Up until recently, the standards for how you produce chemicals have been set by the U.S. because it is the biggest market in the world. And so if you want to you know, produce on a world scale, you have to produce to U.S. standards. Well, the Europeans are now establishing their own set of chemical standards, and their market is bigger than ours. They have 450 million people. And there's some question as to what will happen to the global chemical regulations and therefore the cost of doing business for the chemical industry. And so the U.S. has been trying to water down the European versions of these chemical standards. And if the Europeans were clearly dependent on U.S. military power to secure the long-term safety of their energy supplies, that would give the U.S. important leverage in those types of negotiations. Another example would be the banana wars that were ultimately brought to the WTO, the World Trade Organization, and the U.S. won. But what happened was Europe was buying bananas from its former colonies at preferential prices, and this was cutting American-based firms that produce in Central America out of the European market. And the U.S. wanted to get into those markets, and they kept negotiating outside of the WTO to try and get the Europeans to stop essentially subsidizing bananas from the Caribbean and Africa to allow cheaper bananas produced by U.S. companies in other words, to give those markets up to the U.S. It eventually went to the WTO and the U.S. won, but it might not have gone that far had the U.S. had the type of overarching power that it had during the Cold War, where all these European states were beholden to the U.S. and its military umbrella that kept away the Soviet Union. Another example of, and probably the primary example in terms of thinking about Iraq, is the role of China. A quarter of all U.S. trade is with China. There's a lot of talk about the rivalry between the U.S. and China, but it's important to remember how symbiotically connected these two economies are. Neither economy can do without the other. But that doesn't mean it's always smooth sailing. We have an enormous trade deficit with China. Last year, we bought and borrowed $202 billion more than we sold and lent to China. In the context of that trade deficit, the U.S. has been trying to pressure China to raise essentially the price of the yuan, its currency, because the argument of U.S. trade officials is that the Chinese government keeps the Chinese currency artificially low. And what this does is basically makes Chinese goods artificially cheap. I mean, of course, Chinese goods are cheap because the price of doing business in China is so much cheaper, but the argument is that there's a further discount in that the currency is artificially suppressed. So the U.S. has been urging China to make the Chinese currency more expensive, thus making Chinese goods more expensive, thus making U.S. goods less expensive, thus alleviating the trade balance. So this has not been going so well, as they're perennially making trips to China. Well, China, with 1.3 billion people, has been growing at 9 or 10% a year, which is a lot, for a decade. They were a net oil exporter until 1993, when they became a net oil importer. And they're growing so fast that they essentially have to invest very heavily in building coal plants. They invest very heavily in alternative energy. They also have, though their economy in energy terms is overall pretty inefficient, they are making great efforts to conserve their use of energy. Yet, due to the rate of growth, they still have to import enormous amounts of foreign oil, and most of that is coming from the Middle East. So currently, China gets 32% of its oil is imported, and that's expected to go up to 70% by, I think, 2020. And so far, right now, 58% of that oil comes from the Middle East, and by 2015, 70% of that oil will come from the Middle East. So if the U.S. had successfully established military bases and remade the region around Iraq, and it was clear that the thing that held that place together and secured the safety of the oil that the Chinese economy desperately needs is the U.S. military, think of all of the types of indirect but important leverage that would bring to discussions such as the one around the price of the yuan, which is connected to some very fundamental issues about the health of the U.S. and therefore global economy and the profitability of U.S. assets. So I think that was one of the main reasons why the U.S., before George Bush, had been moving towards militarizing the Middle East and attacking Saddam Hussein, because this was a way of situating U.S. forces there. Why did the Clinton arrangements of sanctions and containment, why did that have to fall apart? Why did they not just continue that indefinitely? Part of the reason has to do with the fact that Saudi Arabia, where our bases were, was getting displeased with having foreign troops there. This was becoming a very serious bone of contention. This is one of the things that animates the imagination of Osama bin Laden. This was like the reason he turned against the Saudi state. He had been, you know, essentially a Saudi prince. The bin Laden family weren't royalty, but they're very close to royalty. He went to Afghanistan during the anti-Soviet jihad in lieu of a Saudi prince going. The Afghan Mujahideen kept wanting some prominent Saudi to come, and the most prominent Saudi they could get was Osama bin Laden, the son of this construction magnate. So there was also several bombings against U.S. targets, the Khobar Tower, the Riyadh bombing in a year before. There was a growing frustration among the Saudi middle class, and the Saudi middle class are very, very wealthy, and they've been funding a kind of homegrown terrorist campaign of their own. And they began in the 1990s, but have picked up pace in more recent years, armed engagements between Saudi fundamentalist urban guerrillas and the security forces. And the critique of these guerrillas is that this regime is corrupt, which it is, and that they're defying Islam by allowing foreign troops there. So there was a lot of pressure to get out of Saudi Arabia, which we have in fact done. So where to go next? Well, it became the idea of Iraq and establishing imposing regime change, establishing a client regime, using Iraq as a place for military bases, and then moving on to other places. The second reason for the war, I think, had to do with direct economic interests. So if the geostrategic is about indirect and the political use of economic assets for political or economic goals somewhere down the line, the second main reason was that there are a lot of corporations that stood to benefit enormously from going to war. The primary ones were the oil industry. And before the war, before 9/11, in fact, in March 2001, Dick Cheney's Energy Task Force held meetings with U.S. oil companies where they discussed how they would proceed if there was regime change to privatize Iraq's oil. Cheney refused to release the documents, the minutes from these meetings, the maps, and it took an interesting combination of the Sierra Club, a liberal organization, and Judicial Watch, a very right-wing libertarian organization, coming together to sue to get the release of these documents. And they revealed that this is, in fact, what had been planned. They had maps labeled foreign suitors for Iraqi oil field contracts, and the discussion was how to divvy up Iraq's oil. That project is obviously not been completed because Iraq is in meltdown, so too is the oil industry. They're actually currently debating an oil law, and it's not clear at all. I wrote a piece in this week's Nation about this oil law. It's not at all clear what kind of oil law will be passed in Iraq or whether it will have any traction or whether there will even be an Iraq in several years. But that was clearly one constituency that pushed for war. Then there's the question of contracting. For military contracting, military services, and reconstruction. And last time I was here, I talked about Halliburton. I'm sure you all know a lot about Halliburton, but briefly, Dick Cheney ran it. He was, before he was vice president, he was head of Halliburton. His major contribution to that company was to buy another company called Dreiser. Unfortunately for him, Dreiser had a bunch of outstanding asbestos lawsuits, and so Halliburton ended up essentially buying this debt. And it was between $5 and $7 billion, depending how you do the math and how it all shakes out in court. So Halliburton went into the red until it got these no-bid contracts that are so famous in Iraq, and that managed to just resuscitate it. And then speaking of Halliburton and its contracts, we could probably talk about this in afterwards, but there's a Halliburton connection to the scandal at Walter Reed. The reason that the wounded soldiers at Walter Reed have been living in squalor, it turns out, is because this firm called IAP, which is run by a former Halliburton executive, got a contract that nobody seemed to know was on offer to privatize the services at Walter Reed. And so what they did to increase their profits was cut the operations and maintenance staff from 300 people to 100. And surprise, surprise, the place got covered in mold and cockroaches. So arms contractors are also making enormous amounts of money, not necessarily because they're making Humvees and spare tires and body armor, but because the spectacle of war, the threat and the sort of emotional blackmail that goes along with the discourse of war, that if you do not approve every single item in the military budget, you're abandoning the troops. What that allows for is a type of corporate welfare. So last year, the military budget was $445 billion, much higher than it had ever been. Well, it was not all for body armor and Humvees for Iraq. There was $69 billion alone for military R&D, which is just essentially, you know, doing math and charging the government. The vast majority of these military R&D projects don't work out. They throw money at these contractors. A very good friend of mine, actually, a guy I went to high school with, is an inventor and makes things for the military. And he's describing how insane it is that the Defense Department is never denying them money. And they're testing, my friend's firm is testing a pilotable parachute. So it'd be a way of like piloting a cargo parachute, loads of cargo. And they realize that it's not going to work in winds above 30 miles an hour, which means it's basically never going to work. And they told this to the Defense Department. And the Defense Department was just giving them money. They're like, well, we have this money for you, so whatever, keep spending it. Another $79 billion last year for weapon systems procurement, high-tech weapon system procurement that had nothing to do with the safety of troops in Iraq on the ground. So these profits accrue to firms like Lockheed Martin, the largest arms contractor in the U.S. Lockheed Martin contains in its leadership characters like Bruce Jackson, who by day is director of strategic planning for Lockheed Martin, and by night volunteers for political causes and was a founding member of the Committee for the Liberation of Iraq, which basically was a quote-unquote grassroots organization lobbying Congress, working with journalists to build a consensus for war. And obviously, Bruce Jackson had concerns other than the freedom and safety of the Iraqi people. And as a result of this war, Lockheed Martin's profits have jumped. In 2005, they jumped 41%. I don't know what they were for last year, but I imagine they were pretty high. All through this, too, you know, I would indict my own profession. Journalists and their willingness to curry favor with power and say things that are popular also help build war fever, and that helps their careers and is a key part of how this war came about. And then the final reason for why this war happened and why we cannot get out of it, I think, is party politics and political egos. That it's pretty clear at this point to most people in the U.S. Congress that the situation requires some sort of new drastic measures, probably that look a lot like a withdrawal of U.S. troops. This was the message of the Iraq Study Group report, which was convened by James Baker, who was Secretary of State under George Bush I. And what it proposed, it was a bipartisan commission. What it proposed was, I thought, a very reasonable plan for convening regional peace conferences, trying to contain the violence, getting all the neighboring states to acknowledge their interests in containing the escalating chaos so that it didn't spill over into Iran or Saudi Arabia. And this was rejected by the Bush administration. Why was it rejected? It was rejected for party political reasons, that the Bush administration and many in the GOP who know better do not want to go down in history as the party that not only started this war but then lost it. And Bush even said it when he was asked by a journalist, well, how exactly are we going to get out of Iraq? If, in fact, you don't have plans for permanent bases, how do we get out of Iraq? He said, well, I don't know. That's for the next president to do because it's not going to happen on my watch. And I interpret that as the fact that these people do not want to be tarred with this defeat. So regardless of what the facts are, 10 years down the line, chances are, you know, we're likely to have a Democratic president next. It's been a long run for the Bush administration. The Republican Party is being attached to him, is in disrepute in many places. Democrats will, quote unquote, lose the war. 10 years down the line, people can say, well, you know, things could have been different in Iraq, but, you know, the Democrats, they just didn't have the nerve, and so they folded up shop and went home. That will be good for the Republicans in the future. And so they're willing to keep spending your money and keep sending you and your friends to Iraq to die and to allow the situation in Iraq to fester like a gangrenous wound, the effects of which we don't know what will be if it's not staunched, if there isn't some sort of triage. They're allowed to do that. They're willing to do that for another 2 years because it will help their individual careers, their place in history, and the fortunes of their party down the line. So that's the situation we face, and I think that it is incumbent upon all of us, regardless of the differences we have on various other political questions, to acknowledge the fact that the current strategy in Iraq is not working and that something has to happen for the sake of the U.S. taxpayer, for the sake of regular people in this country. We're spending $8 billion a month in Iraq. There are so many needs here in the U.S. that are going unmet for the sake of regional stability in Iraq and for the sake of Iraqis, that we're not, unfortunately, serving to contain the violence, but only to antagonize things. But I would say, finally, in closing, that I do not have any illusions whatsoever about what the effects of a U.S. pullout of Iraq I won't say would be, but will be. The situation there is going to get worse before it gets better. And this is something that Americans have to think about. I think too often we're conditioned to think that every story has a happy ending or can have a happy ending, and that every problem has a solution. And we carry to politics sometimes the logic of shopping, that I ordered the democracy set of sneakers, the democracy in the Middle East brand sneakers, and I got the endless sectarian warfare brand instead. Could I return them? Maybe if it's sneakers, but not if it's history. So we have to deal with the very severe limitations. So I'm not saying, oh, the U.S. is the only problem in Iraq now, and if we leave, everything will be great. No, that's not the case. What I'm saying is that the situation in Iraq is fundamentally beyond our control, and that all we can do is try and exit there gracefully by essentially, I would say, following the suggestions of the Baker-Hamilton, that is the Iraq Study Group report, which called for a regional peace conference and also a peace conference that involves the Israeli-Palestinian issue and a number of other things. But I've been going on and on, so I'll...
This program was produced by the LA Sound Posse. The LA Sound Posse records speeches and events dealing with social justice issues. We use the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Share-Alike 2.5 license to ensure the ongoing public availability of these recordings. We share them via the Internet, community radio, and CDs distributed through grassroots, social justice groups, nonprofit organizations, committed individuals, and others. Our goal is to be a part of the creation of a broad-based, participatory, and democratic civic media in support of a truly democratic society. You can reach us on the web at www.lasoundposse.org. Contact us for copies of this program on CD. You can download it for free at radioforall.net. That's www.radio4all.net. If you value what you heard in this program, please feel free to copy and distribute it to others who you think would benefit from hearing it, and thus becoming yourself a part of a decentralized, democratic, civic media.
We'll conclude with an interview with anarchist anthropologist David Graeber, who spoke with Indie Media's Chris Burnett about an article Graeber published in the January edition of Harper's Magazine.
Your article is entitled Army of Altruists on the Alienated Right to Do Good, and I thoroughly enjoyed reading this. And I think what I want to do is I just want to jump to the punchline at the end, sort of the million-dollar question, ironically, is why do working-class Bush voters tend to resent intellectuals more than they do the rich? And it seems the answer is simple. They can imagine a scenario in which they might become rich, but cannot possibly imagine one in which they or any of their children would become members of the intelligentsia. That's an interesting statement, and I think a lot of people that I've had conversations with really want to get to an understanding of the class issues that surround why people who are considered working class or poor join the military and vote for Bush. And I think you address a lot of these in this article.
Well, yeah, I was obviously a bit puzzled and concerned by the phenomena myself. I'm from a working class background. I did manage to get myself into what passes for a liberal intelligentsia in America, but somehow I've never been quite accepted as part of it. I guess the real origins of the piece came about after the election in 2004. Actually, I was teaching at Yale at the time. I was supposed to teach a seminar, and none of us were really in a mood to discuss Max Weber's theories of religion. So we all kind of sat around and pondered, well, is all this theory stuff we do actually good for anything? Can we actually explain why things like this happen? And this piece is what came out of that.
You mentioned that you were at a talk by one of your...
Kathy Lutz.
Kathy, yeah. And she's describing a situation where she's looking at military bases around the world and looking at the response of soldiers. And one of the things that they seem to be very excited about when they're doing these community programs in which they're, you know, providing medical aid or whatever it may be, is that their response is, this is why I joined the Army. This is what military service is all about, not just defending your country, but helping people.
Yeah, and I've actually, immediately after that, there was the tsunami in Southeast Asia, and I was reading in the newspaper these interviews of soldiers who were giving out free medical aid and helping people, refugees and whatnot, and that was exactly what they were saying, you know, this is why I joined the Army. I realized, my God, these people really want to be in the Peace Corps. But then I thought about it, and I realized that, you know, if you're from that kind of background, you can't even get into the Peace Corps. I mean, at this point, you practically have to have an MBA to even think about going to the Peace Corps. It raised the question to me that, in a way, our class system is based on a kind of a differential distribution of the right to think about higher things, either to be altruistic or to think about anything other than money. Selfishness isn't, you know, we like to think of selfishness as somehow inherent in human nature, and when people seem to be behaving altruistically, really they've got an angle. There's some, usually we assume that there's something hidden behind it. And it occurred to me as maybe it's the other way around. Our society is this gigantic mechanism where we're all in competition for the right to behave altruistically.
Well, that's what you said. I mean, the article is essentially understanding the difference between egoism and altruism and going into sort of deeper into the American psyche and trying to analyze why that might be. And there's a lot of issues that you raise. And it's sort of like the very existence of altruistic behavior, right, is considered a kind of puzzle. And everyone from economists to evolutionary biologists has become famous through attempts to solve it, quote unquote, and to solve this mystery. And in the article, you go through three propositions, which I find kind of fascinating. The first one is neither egoism nor altruism is a natural urge. They, in fact, arise in relation to each other, and neither would be conceivable without the market. Let's talk about that, because I think that's a really important point, because you bring in anthropology and sort of the rise of the market, which is sort of a materially based worldview, and alternately the rise of religion.
Yes, because they happened right around the same times and places. There's a little bit of a literature on the rise of Greek philosophy and why it seems to happen at exactly the same time and place as you get money. But I was sort of inspired by that, and I started thinking about it, and I realized that, well, world religions, there's a period called the Axial Age, where almost all the modern world religions arose within 500 years of one another. Some of them within the same generation in different parts of the world. Well, what else was happening at that time was exactly rise of money, especially impersonal coined money. And sort of credit money had existed long before. So you have these impersonal markets coming in. And at exactly the same times and places, people invent world religions, which almost invariably not only have a sort of universalistic message, but talk about charity all the time.
Right, so they sort of introduce the concept of charity from the church or other religious organizations.
Right, and it's interesting because in the sorts of economies that existed beforehand, anthropologists like to refer to them as gift economies. Charity didn't exist, but on the other hand, economies were based on what we would consider gifts. People were, in fact, competing to see who could be the most generous often. But at the same time, the generosity was often, you know, anything but charity. You give gifts to your enemies to show up how much richer you are than them or how much more generous. The motives were just much, much more complicated and subtle than, you know, just being nice to others or getting stuff for yourself. I realize that really what you have is the rise of certain institutions which strip down human behavior to this kind of basic, very, very simple level that you never act with people that you actually know and have personal feelings about one way or the other. So really, both the market and charity are ways you deal with strangers. And once you get markets where you're dealing with strangers and you don't really care who they are but just want to get as much stuff off them as possible, it sort of seems almost inevitable that you get kind of dialectical opposition to that. Once you set aside a space and say, okay, here you just think about material stuff and getting stuff for yourself, then someone will also say, well, here, let's think about how the self isn't really important and material things aren't important and, in fact, we should give to others.
Right,
and
you
sides of the same coin.
Right, and so there's sort of the opposites and in the sense they're in that dialectical relationship that you refer to. And in fact, you say in your article, which I think is accurate, it's an interesting question. The U.S., which is the most market-driven industrialized society on Earth, is also among the most religious.
Yeah, it doesn't seem a coincidence. Whereas you look at some place like Russia, where they tried to eliminate both religion and the market at the same time.
And this goes directly into your sort of second proposition, which is that has to do with the issue of the right. The political right has always tried to enhance this division and thus claims to be the champion of both egoism on the one hand and altruism simultaneously, or egoism and altruism simultaneously. The left has tried to efface it. And just to be clear, egoism being sort of the self-interested market and altruism sort of aligned maybe with the religious right.
Precisely, which do in fact raise enormous amounts of money and charity. And they like to boast that Republicans give much more in charity than Democrats, and that socialist countries give less, and people give less in charity than in capitalist ones. And while there are reasons for that, obviously, they don't have to so much in countries in Europe. But nonetheless, they're very proud of their charity, and they talk about it all the time.
Continue.
It's part of the mix. But not simply that charity, it's that sense of values in general. They talk about the monopoly on values, that somehow the right has managed to grab this monopoly on value, whether it's family values, religious values, ideals in one sort of or another. And it's all part of this scam that seems to go back to the very origins of the idea of a right wing, I mean, early 19th century, where on the one hand, you encourage the market, and the market just throws everything into chaos. And then on the other hand, you go off and say, oh, there is chaos. We will defend traditional values against the barbarians. And, of course, they're the barbarians that you have yourself unleashed.
And as you write, it's a remarkably effective scam, and one that results one result is that the right ends up seeming to have a monopoly on value. And,
exactly.
And to occupy both positions at the same time, egoism and altruism.
Because otherwise, why would you have libertarians and Christian fundamentalists in the same party at all? It makes no sense. But if you look back at right-wing coalitions, even in the 19th century, early 20th century, under fascists, whatever they call themselves, it always seems to have both of those elements mixed together, even though they seem completely contradictory.
Right. I want to remind listeners that I'm speaking with David Graeber. David Graeber is an anarchist and anthropologist. He is an associate professor of anthropology at Yale University, although Yale has controversially declined to rehire him, and his term there will end in June 2007. He's the author of Fragments of an Anarchist Anthropology and Towards an Anthropological Theory of Value, The False Coin of Our Own Dreams. As of January 2007, he's preparing four books for future publication, two of them, Possibilities, a Book of Essays, and Direct Action, an Ethnography, are already written and in the process of review by AK Press. Two more, one, A History of the Concept of Debt, the other, an attempt to outline an anarchist version of world systems analysis, are work still in progress. David, let's continue on with the third proposition that you bring up in the article, and that is, the real problem of the American left is that although it does try in certain ways to efface the division between egoism and altruism, value and values, it largely does so for its own children. This has allowed the right, paradoxically, to represent itself as the champion of the working class.
Yeah, well, that's the core of my thesis. The argument is, to a certain degree, historical. It's about what happened to the generation of the 60s. You notice that all over the world, in 68, for example, there were student rebellions in France and Mexico and the United States. And, of course, in the U.S., usually that's attributed to the war. And, of course, I'm sure that's the first thing that was on people's minds. But at the same time, you know, why was it happening everywhere in the world at once? It's kind of a puzzle, even places which weren't actually fighting wars. And one of the conclusions I came to was the effects of a certain kind of social engineering. One reason that you want to expand your educational system, which people in the 50s had been doing all over the world, is sort of provide this image of universal mobility, that working-class kids, you know, if they're smart at all, can rise above and don't have to be working class anymore. America was based on this ideal that being a wage laborer is not something that is permanent. You know, either you do it in the beginning of your life and you move on to something else, or if you're an immigrant, you work in the factories and then your kid will go on to something else. Of course, it's easy to maintain that when you have a frontier to put people on. When the frontier closes up, it becomes a problem. And I think they tried, in the U.S. at least, to handle that by expanding the educational system. And it grew tremendously, it was very intentional, in the 50s and 60s. It's the same period where social mobility was actually on the rise. It's been shrinking since in the U.S. The problem is you always hit a wall, because it's a little bit like a pyramid scheme. You know, you can turn out all these people and then employ them in expanding the educational system and so forth even further. But eventually you're going to come to a point where you have a generation that simply has no place to go. You have all these highly educated people who are angry, can't get jobs on anything like the level that they've been trained to, and of course they have access to the entire history of radical thought. And this is how revolutions happen in many parts of the world. We suppose people almost invariably end up being the leaders of them. Now, it started to happen in the U.S., and it seems like First of all, they scaled back the educational system quickly and enormously, at least access to the educational system for most of the working class. The other thing that happened, though, and this is the core of my argument, and the kind of part of it that is perhaps the least welcome to a lot of Harper's readers, I'm afraid, is that in a certain way, the generation that was in college in the 60s, who almost all, at least retrospectively, think of themselves as radicals, were reabsorbed and kind of offered this deal that, okay, you know, you wanted to revolutionize society and efface the difference between egoism and altruism entirely. That didn't work out, but we'll give you, it, as long as you shut up and behave yourselves, we'll give you a deal where you can do that at least for your own kids. So the jobs whereby you get paid to do good in the world, or even to pursue values other than money, are more and more relegated to sort of an intermarrying elite, which the rest of America hates. And if you look at right-wing rhetoric, right-wing populist rhetoric at least, it's all about elites. They're always talking about the Hollywood elite, the medical elite, the educational elite, the liberal elite. And I think one thing that radicals don't necessarily want to recognize is there's something to what they say. One of the examples that I think is most telling is Hollywood. You know, the sort of ideal of Hollywood, the dream anyway, was that, you know, anybody could be discovered and become a star. You know, some school, some, you know, daughter of farmers from Nebraska can go off and go to Hollywood and become a big star, be discovered. I don't know if that happened all that often, but it was, people believed that that could happen in the 1950s. Nowadays, you look at Hollywood and, like, you know, you look at the cast of a movie, every single one of them, their parents and their grandparents were all Hollywood people. It's like a caste system.
Right.
And, and as a result, you know, you could only imagine what most Americans think when they see these guys all claiming to be lefties and radicals. It's like, that's ridiculous.
Yeah. It's sort of resentment against these, the elitists. It's a gut response to elitism.
Yeah, and to the sense of, like, okay, you claim to be, like, for the little guy, but you wouldn't let the little guy get anywhere near anything you think is important.
You know, and going back to the altruism versus egoism, in your closing argument, so to speak, you say, this is, of course, the secret of nobility. To be noble is to be generous, high-minded, altruistic, to pursue higher forms of value, but it is also to be able to do so because one does not really have to think too much about money. This is precisely what our soldiers are doing when they give free dental examinations to villagers. They are being paid to do good in the world.
Exactly. And it's the only way they can actually be paid to do good in the world. If you come from, you know, the background most people in America come from, is to also have to put your life at risk. It's, I think that's the terrible tragedy. And that political formula, you know, we hate the liberal elite, support the troops, I think, you know, comes directly from that.
You say, and this is an important point, and I really like this line, because like any teenager, or you're responding to why people in the peace movement don't understand why working class people join the army.
Yeah.
And it is, you say, like any teenager, they want to escape the world of tedious work and meaningless consumerism, to live a life of adventure and camaraderie in which they believe they are doing something genuinely noble. They join the army because they want to be like you. And by you, I assume you mean the audience that will be reading Harper's.
Yeah, I mean, it was a kind of a clever little rhetorical move, because it's like you, the peace activist, and also you, the party, reading the article.
Well, let's talk about that. It makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, no statement like that is universally true. There are people who join the army because they want to kill people. There are people who join the army because they want to go to college. But I think there's a very, very large number who do it for exactly that reason.
Well, and it goes back again to America's promise of unlimited upward mobility, and you know, the working class, as you say, is traditionally been seen as a way station, and someone's family passes through it on the road to something else, and that was the promise of higher education. And as as we know, in the 80s and 90s, those doors were shut. In the University of California here, they've affirmative action was eliminated, the price has skyrocketed, etc. And a lot of other things, I'm sure.
And the really evil thing that happened was that they shut off access to, on economic grounds, at the same time as they opened it up in a very, very limited way to groups that had been excluded completely. So, you know, for example, the GI Bill, you know, black people were not allowed, even black veterans basically couldn't use the GI Bill. It was basically a white male program. So at the same time as they started reversing programs of systematic racism and sexism to a certain degree in colleges, they made them much more hard to get access to higher education, especially liberal arts education, for everybody. So the result was that, you know, you get this backlash, which isn't directed against the people who are really responsible, but instead takes the form of this terrible racism and sexism.
Now, from an activist point of view, an organizer's point of view, how do you take this understanding, and what do you see as creation of an alternative paradigm, dialogue, discussion, you know, through whatever organizations? How does one take that and run with it, challenge it?
You know, that's the real question. I'm still thinking about it. I think that there's a kind of a struggle over institutions. The way I like to think of it is institutions for the creation of people. And this is part of the value argument that didn't make it into that article. If you look at some of the focus for both left and right populism, it's very interesting. There's a kind of a focus on institutions of education and medical institutions. And what are the two big right-wing populist causes? They're anti-evolution and anti-abortion. And, you know, like, one is sort of direct attack on the authority of universities, and the other one a direct attack on the authority of hospitals and the medical elite, as they call them. At the same time, those are the institutions where the left is trying to unionize, because those are the institutions which I think are becoming more and more predominant in our society. Many cities in America are being reorganized around universities and hospitals. Those are the largest single employers in, you know, any number of different cities. Even in New York, they're like 3 in 5, I think. And New York is the financial capital in the world. Cities like Baltimore, that's pretty much all that's left. So in a way, you know, what you have are these institutions which are basically about creating human beings, and that's what life is ultimately about, is a process of mutual creation. And the institutional engines through which this is done become the big stakes for political struggle right now. I don't know exactly what that means in organizing terms, right, but I think it's very important to think about.
In a very simple question, how do young people who may not have access to the university, how do we find a way to channel that altruism that people have? And it seems to me that it's going to take sort of a paradigm shift in the language and what is considered altruistic, and what, you know, what's really going on with market capitalism. It seems to me that there needs to be in place some kind of approach to addressing these. If this is true, this tension between egoism and altruism.
Yeah, well, I mean, the problem, of course, is that people need to eat. And that's, you know, the great problem for anarchist organizing. I mean, we provide all sorts of models for alternative ways in which you can pursue higher forms of value in ways which are not complicit in reproducing systems of structural violence and inequality. Problem is, you're going to have to be willing to either dumpster dive or do odd jobs, and, you know, a lot of people don't really want to do that for much of their life, and certainly don't want to do it when they hit 40 or 50. I mean, the big question is, that's why I talk about nobility. I mean, as I say, nobility is ability to actually, you know, be clean and tidy and not have to think about money, and things just kind of take care of themselves so you can think about higher stuff. Right. To do that, you have to be in a certain economic position. And it's a problem which, I mean, to some degree, revolutionary change of some kind is one of the only ways you can do it. I think one of the more hopeful things that comes out of my analysis is that, you know, military people and activists and anarchists have more in common than we think. And there's possibilities, as in the Vietnam War, where there was a huge anti-war movement within the military itself. It's possible that, you know, there's a lot more possibilities for that kind of organizing than we think, for people to make connections. And what I always remind anarchists, too, is that, you know, we're never going to win a war against the U.S. government. I mean, it's absurd. War is what they're good at. When anarchists historically win, it's because the army refuses to shoot at them.
Anthropologist David Graeber, interviewed by Chris Burnett of Indie Media on Air. Thanks to Chris and all of the altruist broadcasters in three countries whose work contributed to the program this week and every week. All of the problems we face, I believe, can be solved when amassing wealth and power, or fear of losing it, ceases to be the driver of our decisions. In a peaceful future, all lunches will be free.
Condoleezza, check my posse. Me, me, me.